And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and today we are crossing to Boston, USA, to speak with our special guest, Dr. David Sinclair, AO. David is one of the world's most famous scientists, best known for understanding why we age and how to reverse it. He is a tenured professor at Harvard Medical School, co-joint professor at the University of New South Wales, and honorary professor at the University of Sydney. David has published more than 170 scientific papers and has received 35 honours, including an Officer of the Order of Australia. He is the author of the new book Lifespan, Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To. David, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So, David, there is a deep fascination with the subject matter of your new book at an individual level, like how long before I die. But perhaps at a general level, people might say, oh, lifespan is 3 score plus 10 or 70. What do you mean by lifespan?
Well, so lifespan and health span go together, and it turns out most of what kills all of us, it's not heart disease, it's not cancer, it's not Alzheimer's, not frailty, not diabetes. What's driving all of those diseases is aging. Right? So we used to think that cancer was just a natural part of life. 100 years ago, we told people to go home and pack their things, get their things in order. We now treat it aggressively as a disease that's actually curable. And the same is happening in the aging field. I've been in this for 25 years since I came to the United States for a couple of years. I stayed a little longer. But the point is that aging is at the same point that we were in the 1970s with cancer, that we now have a pretty good understanding of what causes it and even have some ways to measure what's going on and then even treat it. And certainly slow it down is well within current capabilities and new discoveries, which I've written in the book, that are only just a couple of years old now, and even scientists, their heads are spinning, is that we can actually reprogram parts of the body to be young again.
You mentioned just then that, and you describe in your book, how aging is a disease. And this is a new way of thinking about it, isn't it? Because people tend to look at the individual things like diabetes 2, heart disease, Alzheimer's, but they don't get the overall picture that perhaps it's aging that's the factor behind all those things.
Exactly. And if you look up the definition of a disease, it's something that happens to you over time and you get sick and sometimes you die. And the same thing is true for aging. The only difference is if something bad happens to you health-wise, and it happens to 49.9% of the country, we call that a disease. If it happens to 51%, then we'll call that aging. And that's a totally arbitrary cutoff. And what's important about calling it a disease is that it would be treatable. It would be that your doctor could say, okay, we've measured your biological age. You've hit the age of 60 or whatever number that we want to call it, and we can treat it. We can slow it down. We can prevent, we now believe, many of the diseases that are caused by aging itself. And so that's a really important way to think about aging. And the other thing often comes up is, well, I don't want to live any longer because I've seen what old age looks like. Well, we're talking about an old age that could be much more vibrant, more productive, less time spent in illness. So instead of keeping people in nursing homes for another 10 years, what we're talking about is keeping them healthy and younger for another 10 years. And when I explain it that way, then it actually makes total sense. Even the World Health Organization agrees with me that old age is a medical condition that we should work on. One last thing is, if we cured cancer today or cured heart disease, we'd only extend lifespan by about 1 to 2 years on average, and that's really quite sad and pathetic. So what we need to do now that we've bumped up against aging as the major cause of death is we need to work on that rather than just treating its symptoms.
Yes, maybe it needs a new word or something, because the idea for a lot of people of spending, say, an extra 10 or 20 years in a nursing home doesn't sound very attractive. But I think your message is it's the vitality, and so you've got 80-year-olds perhaps performing in every way as like a 40-year-old.
Well, it is, and so I called the book Lifespan, but it could have quite easily been called Healthspan. That's a word we'd like to use. And what we find with our studies, we do a lot of studies on rodents and mice, but we can make them live 20% longer by giving them molecules or giving them certain diets. And then they die fairly quickly within a matter of a week or so. So that would be a life that, if it was possible in humans, we could push lifespan out much longer in a healthy way. So it's we call it compressing morbidity and stretching out the health span. And my father is living a life like that. He's doing all the right things. He's studying the research. He's taking a few of the molecules we've studied. And, you can argue whether it's working or not, but he's now 80 and feeling as good as he did when he was in his 30s and really enjoying life. He's gone back to start a new career and just ordered a new sports car.
Yeah, look, I love the way you've woven your family stories throughout the book. Actually, your father's a great story, but I guess there are going to be ethical questions raised, aren't there? And if a reset switch is available or can be turned on, should we look at living in perpetuity?
I don't think we'll ever be living forever. There's nothing that I know of that makes that possible. It'd be like asking the Wright brothers, how are we going to travel to Mars? It just, there's nothing in the works. More importantly, it's like asking the Wright brothers, you should be asking them, what does the next 5 years look like? What does the next 10 years look like? And that was a pretty interesting time to live through. And the same is going to happen within our lifetimes. And so it's not really about trying to live forever. It's about trying to address the biggest economic and medical problem of most of the planet, eventually all of the planet, with billions of people about to spend a large part of their lives in a state that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. And this is literally the only way of tackling that problem in an economical way, rather than playing whack-a-mole medicine and hitting each disease one at a time and barely extending our lifespan that way.
You give an example of Greenland sharks living to 510. I'm just wondering, do they suffer a loss of vitality when they get to about 400?
I don't actually know that for a fact. But most species that live a long time tend to remain very healthy and vigorous right up until the end. There are trees that, of course, live many thousands of years. The bristlecone pine can live a few thousand. And trees that have been looked at that age are still just as healthy and produce just as many healthy seeds as they did when they were young. So it's possible in biology to live a very long time in a vigorous way. And, you might say, well, we're not trees and we're not sharks, but there are warm-blooded mammals that live 100 years longer than we do, the bowhead whale, for example. So it's not against the laws of biology. We tend to think we're the longest-lived, top-of-the-food-chain kind of creature, but we're not perfect by any means. We have a lot of baggage in our genome that isn't great. We lose our eyesight, we need glasses. There are a lot of flaws that we've inherited, and we've never needed to live longer than about 40 years anyway during the last few hundred thousand years. So now, just like everything else around our lives, we've got cars, air conditioning, medicine. This is another thing that we need to address to make our lives better. And why would we ever accept suffering when we didn't have to? We should be working on this.
Of course, there are always people who are going to object to just about anything, and some people might say, oh, well, we've all got to die. It's the natural order. And I think even your daughter at one stage quizzed you about why you want people to live longer. The history is actually when there are more people, conditions for everyone seem to improve, don't they?
Right. Well, if you raise the health of a country, and we're seeing this in Africa now, then you get wealth. And if you get wealth, then you get health. And it's this virtual wealth-health cycle that has lifted the Western world out of poverty. It's lifted China increasingly out of poverty for a whole middle class. But you have to work on the health first, because you can't have wealth if your population is dragging you down financially because of healthcare costs. And the US is paying the price now. They haven't invested a lot in preventative medicine. They haven't addressed obesity. And their average age is not increasing at the end of life. They're stuck. But countries actually, like Australia, they're doing very well. They've put a lot of money into improving the lives of elderly, and it's paying off. You can see Australia is economically doing very well relative to many other countries. But the trade-off, it's not all perfect. The trade-off is that we will not be able to retire halfway through our lives. That just doesn't make sense. Instead, it's going to be more like my father, where you can try a new career or try a new, some other, even a non-profit organization is the kind of thing that you'll be wanting to do. And I'll tell you what, if you're active and healthy like my father is, you don't want to sit around all day and watch TV or sit in a wheelchair. You want to get going and go see the world.
And we're speaking today with Dr. David Sinclair, who is the author of a new fascinating book called Lifespan: Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To. David, about this point of the show, we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which one you picked and perhaps why you picked it?
Well, I picked a song that I grew up with. I was about 11 years old when this came out, and it's Funky Town by Lips, Inc. The reason I picked it is that it was, I think it, because it was a one-hit wonder, it's not recognized as the revolutionary song that it is. It was insanely new. Our ears had never heard anything like it before. You'll hear they've got synthetic tin cans, the voices are synthesized or modified, and then they throw on top of a really great riff, they've got a traditional guitar that just leads the entire tune. So what I love about it is how cutting edge it was. And I wanted to recognize it for what it is and remind everybody of how innovative songs can be, even if they are one-hit wonders.
So the music can be cutting edge as well. Let's listen to Funky Town by Lips, Inc. That was Funky Town by Lips, Inc., as specially chosen for us today by our guest, Dr. David Sinclair, who is the author of a new book called Lifespan: Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To. David, we touched a few minutes ago on the ethics, and in this area, it's an emotional area, and the ethics no doubt limit your research. I mean, a lot of it seems to be done on mice, but even mice have rights. Then you've done a lot of work on yeast. Now, I guess yeast have the advantage that they don't have any rights at all.
Yeah, that's true. That the worst you can cause is a yeast massacre when those experiments don't work. So it was great to start my career with yeast. I learned how to use yeast as a young scientist at UNSW in Sydney. But we've come a long way since yeast. We've come a long way since mice. We've actually seen positive results in clinical trials with humans and with people. And there are now dozens of companies working in this area. And there are a couple of drugs on the market that were developed for other reasons, but are very well believed by scientists to have anti-aging effects. So this isn't some future thing. This is here right now.
Well, and in fact, in 2018, the Chinese researcher He Jianqiu was actually doing some genetic engineering with humans and engineered out the HIV. Have there been any repercussions since he did that research, which was probably never approved by a Western university?
Mm-hmm. Well, he hasn't been heard of in a while, so I think some very bad things might have happened to him. But in terms of the backlash, it wasn't that big. You know, about 20 years ago, if this had happened, and you remember 20 years ago when the stem cell debate came out, there was all sorts of religious debates and ethics. This time it didn't happen, and I wonder why that is. My best guess is that we live in a world where there's a 24-hour news cycle. There's a lot less focus on religion and ethics in politics over here, at least in the U.S., and that might be the reason why. But a lot of scientists immediately stepped up and criticized it, condemned it, and that also helped, I think, that the world realized that it was just one rogue scientist, not the whole community that was trying to do this.
If aging is classified as a disease, that will also assist the funding, no doubt, as far as that research that you're talking about.
Well, it would. The first country to call aging a disease, and I hope that it's Australia, because there would be a huge influx, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of investment to make drugs to treat aging. It would be the biggest blockbuster drug ever to make it on the market. And there are a number of countries that are vying for this position, the Singaporeans, Israel, UK, and even the US FDA is talking about classifying aging as a treatable condition, or at least a medicine or a condition that a doctor could prescribe a medicine to delay or treat, which isn't so outrageous if you put it in those words. Right? If there's already a drug for diabetes that slows aging, and we think there is, then there's not that much harm in prescribing it for the general population, especially if the drug, in this case, only costs a few cents a pill. And the payoffs would be huge, in the billions of dollars for the country that does that. Yeah, but there would also be more money for research, no question, but that's not why I'm doing it. My lab is well-funded. I'm not worried about that. But I am worried about millions and billions of people suffering and living shorter, horrible lives that they don't need to, because we already have the science that we think can delay such things. And it's, you know, you mentioned, people say, oh, well, let's not mess with the natural order of things, we're all going to die. Well, that's true, but that's also what people said 200 years ago, and that was before antibiotics and other things that we take for granted now. And when these drugs are available and people are living, you know, 5-10 years longer with healthy life, then we'll wonder, why did we even argue about this in the first place?
And it is being taken very seriously. I mean, I imagine some people look at you strangely when you say you're working in this area. But are there some 12 universities around the world that are doing this type of research?
Oh, more than that. My guess would be 5,000, 10,000 scientists working on this. Every university now has somebody working on aging. This is mainstream. There have been two Nobel Prizes awarded for it. And we've been publishing in the world's top five journals, my colleagues and I, for the last 20 years. So it's funny to me that the general perception is that this is still a backwater of biology when it's really been at the forefront for so long. But But certainly finally, and maybe thanks in part to my book and me speaking directly to the public rather than through a headline in a newspaper, that the public's finally learning what's been going on all this time and how exciting the science is.
Yeah, and some people are thinking about it. I mean, I think some people have said they might view marriage differently if they thought they're going to be married for, say, 60 years instead of 40 or 50. There are going to be all sorts of implications, perhaps some we haven't even thought of yet.
Yeah, it's true. You better pick your partner well if you're going to spend 100 years with her or him. It's very true. It's going to change the way we look at our lives. But I don't think, you know, let's go back to history. Would anyone want to live an average of 40, 50 years? No, we would never go back to a world like that. And that's going to be true for the future when they look back at today. And we will adapt. I've done the calculations. There's not a lot of overpopulation. There's, as long as we continue conserving resources and not wasting it all, then there's more than enough to go around. Here in the US, we throw out half of our food anyway. Mm. So these concerns that seem quite intuitive are actually not correct. And the trillions of dollars globally that would be saved by just reducing disease by 20%, and we're talking about doing more than that potentially here, those trillions of dollars can be put to retirement, they can be put to conquering or at least trying to slow down climate change, education, all of these good things. And there's nothing else we could do right now to save trillions of dollars in the world's economy. So this is the big one. It's our moonshot and it's our moment if we choose to accept it.
So what would you say is the next frontier in aging research?
Well, this is what I'm so excited about, having published the book. So in Lifespan, as I was writing it, we made a really big discovery, probably the biggest I'll ever make in my career. I've made a few. What we discovered about 18 months ago was that you can, by manipulating a few genes, just completely reset the clock of tissues. Now, this is early days, but it's a proof of concept, and you know, we're talking about animal studies still. But what we've learned is that in all of our cells, in human cells, in mouse cells, and in living animals, you can treat them and not just make them act young, but literally make them young. So if I was to measure the age of a treated eyeball that we can treat in an old mouse, it would be literally young again. We've reset the clock. And in fact, those mice, they get their eyesight back. And so we can now reset the age of the retina. We're going to reset the age of other parts of the animal. But, of course, we're not waiting for those results. We want to treat patients and get this to people who need it. And eye diseases are one of the worst diseases you can have if you lose your sight. And glaucoma, pressure in the eye, is a disease that's just really untreatable. There's nothing you can do besides slow it down. You can't bring back vision. Whereas we've now tested glaucoma in mice. You can give them glaucoma, and then we've treated them. And by reversing the age of their eyeballs, their retinas, they get their vision back. So we hope that within 2 to 3 years, we'll have our first glimpses, excuse the pun, of whether this is going to work in patients who've lost their vision due to glaucoma.
Oh, that is getting close, isn't it? 2 to 3 years. And now I think, from the book, it appears you're about 50 and you've got ambitions to see your great-grandchildren. So what are you actually doing to get on board the bus of living longer?
Yeah, well, so first of all, I'm not afraid of dying. Anyone who's seen me drive knows that for a fact. Unfortunately, I do drive better than I used to. But in any case, I'm not afraid of dying, but I certainly don't want to lose my humanity. I don't want to have to have my kids put me in a home or, you know, feed me with a spoon. That's not a way to end a life. But I'm also now increasingly seen as a role model. I'm now 50, and people can actually tell if they look at me or they look at my blood whether anything I'm doing is actually working. So what do I do? I do a lot of things, and so in the book, part two of Lifespan is about the kind of things you can do in your daily life to, we think, extend your health in old age. St- they are quite active. You know, the usual things are in there, of course, specific types of exercise, things to eat, things to look for, things to avoid. And then there's also the evidence of supplements that are currently available and new ones coming on fairly regularly. And so I have a combination of a diet, of exercise, and of supplements and sleep that I've optimized for myself over the last 20 years, measuring a lot of different things. And that works for me. My father does something very, very similar, and he's going strong too. Now my wife is, you know, she once didn't believe anything that I said because she thought it was unethical and she was not really concerned, but now she's on board. And my brother was accusing me a couple of years ago of using him as the negative control, so he's now gotten on the Sinclair program. But I don't want anyone to live a day longer than they want to. I'm not prescribing anything. I'm not recommending anything. But my family, they're all a bunch of scientists. My wife's a PhD. So they make their own decisions. They see the science, and they say, well, we know it can happen if we don't try anything. That's not pretty either. And so they weigh up the risks and the rewards, and then they make their own decisions. And so far, our family's doing well. But, you know, we've got a long way to go. I don't mean to say this is a clinical trial, but I also do want to mention that I am involved in doing a lot of human clinical trials because it's not just anecdotes. I want to be able to prove that this is correct or at least test it and have medicines within our lifetime that a doctor can prescribe to you to ward off heart disease and cancer and Alzheimer's and even cure diseases like diabetes.
I don't think there's anything much more exciting than the work you're doing, David Sinclair, and we wish you all the best in your research. In fact, we'd love to go on talking, but we've run out of time this week. I just wanted to say that we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this program again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now to give a special thank you. David Sinclair, thank you very much for being on Dads on the Air. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Bill, it's been great to be on. Thank you. And I have a website if you'd like to, or your listeners would like to learn more. It's lifespanbook.com.
Great. And that will be on our website as well. So, yeah, look, this is it's been fantastic. So once again, we'll be back next week with another show. But until then, it's goodbye from Dads on the Air.